a program dedicated to an examination of areas in the human experience not easily nor neatly put in a awakening a part of the mind as yet not mapped. And yet things every bit as real as the air we breathe but don't see. This is Dreamland.
It is Dreamland, another Sunday evening. Good evening, everybody. I'm Art Bell. In Roswell, New Mexico, where it's all been happening. Coming up shortly, in the Badges now, Colonel Philip J. Corso retired, and William J. Burns, who co-authored The Day After Roswell with Colonel Corso. As promised, coming up shortly. In all the years of published books about Roswell and about extraterrestrials, I would venture a guess that none has stirred the pot more heavily than the book we're going to talk about tonight and the man who wrote it, actually men who wrote it. Colonel Philip J. Corso retired along with
You know, it was April 9th, 1983, that I was sitting in that office at Kirtland Air Force Base with Air Force Office of Special Investigations Agent Richard C. Doty. He was handing me a paper that he said that I could read, and I could not take notes, and he made me sit in a chair in the middle of a room that I later learned was because they videotaped and audiotaped my reactions to what I was reading.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And the top of that briefing paper said, in all caps, centered, briefing paper for the President of the United States of America on the subject of identified aerial vehicles in apparent IACS. And when I turned to the next page in the first paragraph of about eight or nine sentences, it listed retrievals of extraterrestrial, and that was the word that was used in that paper that I saw April 9, 1983, of extraterrestrial craft and bodies, both dead and alive, from a series of locations in the southwestern United States and the northern nation of Mexico. And it listed a series of cities and areas, including at least two in the Roswell area in 47 and 49, one as early as 1946, predating all of the historic discussion about 1947. Talked about the retrieval of a craft from northern Mexico south of Laredo, Texas, over the border. Talked about the retrieval of a crash in Kingman, Arizona. And Magdalena, which is out in the near the plains of St. Augustine, and all of that was listed. And the paper went into a historic insight and evolution of how that our government, in terms of confronting having these craft and these beings that they didn't understand what they were or where they came from, had set in motion a series of insider military, medical, and scientific people to study, but to keep all of this information from the public and the media while they ascertained whether there was a national security threat. One of the conversations with Richard Doty that day, April 9, 1983, he mentioned that inside of our United States government, that one of the things that had also helped keep this whole story covered up for nearly half a century was internal conflict between the intelligence agencies in the United States and military branches, that inside of the structures of our government, we had a kind of internecine war going on between various bureaus.
Well, that's not hard to imagine because the military wars between the various branches of its own.
That's right. And in 1947, for the very first time, the United States separated Army Air Force into two separate branches, which added to the confusion in 1947. Well, tonight, I am sitting with a book on my lap. The top says, "The Truth Exposed After 50 Years, a Former Pentagon Official Reveals the United States Government's Shocking UFO Cover-Up, The Day After Roswell," by Colonel Philip J. Corso, retired with William J. Burns, forward by Senator Strom Thurmond. I have read this book from cover to cover, and I have found material that absolutely addresses some of the questions that I've had ever since this description of internal battles within our own intelligence forces and military, and also another area which tonight I hope that we will be able to talk about at least three areas. One is what Philip Corso knew about our government's knowledge of a non-human intelligence and technology and what his assignment was concerning that alien technology, his own extraordinary experiences inside of this internecine warfare that was going on and which he knew and took the position that the Army had to keep at all costs any of this alien technology and any related sensitive areas away from the Central Intelligence Agency, because at that point, coming out of World War II, the Army, the then new Air Force, and the Navy were more concerned about possible KGB spies inside of the Central Intelligence Agency than anything else, and they were afraid that if the material that they collected went into that agency that was controlling intelligence, that they would lose it forever from the American industrial military complex having any hands on. It would be like going into a black hole. And then there is a third area that has been brought up to me over the last 15 years periodically that I have not myself understood. And it has been men who have asked me in my investigations of things like the animal mutilation mystery and others, did I have knowledge about Earth's secret war in relationship to the non-human intelligence and the position that our government had taken in relationship to it. Until the last 2 and 3 days, and a real privilege to sit down and talk in some detail with Colonel Corso and with William Burns, I have had a lot of confusion that I think everyone else does about exactly what has been happening over the last 50 years that has kept its policy of silence and the suggestions that inside our own government there has been tremendous conflict. And what is this Earth Secret War about? Tonight, I think if we start and move through these three large areas, that the Dreamland listening audience is going to find that the whole non-human intelligence area may be part of the heart of an internecine warfare, but that this story is so big and so huge, and I'm sitting with two men that have facets about this that have answered some questions for me, and I hope by the end of these 3 hours, Art, that you and the audience will also realize that this book is one of the most important voices that has emerged in the last 50 years from a man who was there in 1960 to 63 in the Pentagon working with Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau on one of the most provocative challenges that I have ever read anywhere in my life, and that was how to get not understood artifacts retrieved from these disks into the industrial complex of the United States so that it could be hopefully used by military and industry without being swallowed up into the black hole of intelligence that would never let it out. And now I'm going to introduce Colonel Philip J. Corso, retired. The man with a remarkable first-hand experience with this information. And we are working in a Roswell inn where we have been, where we have one phone. We have a difficult phone system here. And what I'm going to do is pose a question to Colonel Corso, and then I'm going to try to help moderate around with this phone so that William Burns will be able to make his comment when he wants and questions and Art, and so you'll understand we have a phone that the three of us are going to share over some of the most important information that I've ever encountered. And I'm going to start with an area that I think that probably Dreamland listeners would like to know something about first and then evolve into these much larger, amazing issues, and that is to have Colonel Corso talk to us about his first-hand experience at Fort Riley, Kansas, back in 1947, when he himself saw what is called an extraterrestrial biological entity. This is Colonel Corso.
Hello? Colonel, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you so much.
Colonel, you saw an extraterrestrial at Fort Riley, Kansas.
Yes. I want to explain to you how that happened. I came back from Italy, and I was in the Pentagon, and I asked for assignment. And they gave me an assignment for Fort Riley. It was garrison duty, and I knew I had garrison duty. And I enjoyed it very much later. But one particular night, I was the post-duty officer. Now, a lot of people seem confused on what that means, not being in the military. That particular night, I was in charge of almost all security, the guards, the walls, and all the buildings in the post, all night long, till morning.
Sure.
I wore a sidearm, and I wore a band on my arm identifying me as a post-duty officer.
What rank were you then?
I was a lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel.
And one of my primary duties was to inspect the guard to make sure they were all on duty, in the right places, and doing their job, not sleeping at 3 o'clock in the morning for them. In fact, one of my duties, on a lighter note, I had an instruction book where I made the notes and my report that I gave to the general the next morning. And one of the lighter notes was, somebody had written in there, and make sure at 1 o'clock in the morning you close the officer club up and throw all the drunks out. That was written in by hand by somebody. So, as post-duty officer, I knew, I was told, there was a sensitive area in one of the veterinarian areas. Now, we had horses then, too. And about 3 in the morning, 2 or 3 in the morning, I went down, I was doing my rounds of the guards, and I stopped in this particular guard, and the master sergeant that I knew very well, I used to bowl with him at the field house, was the sergeant of the guard. And I told him, Sergeant, how you doing here? Is everything quiet? And he said, yes, sir. He said, I told him it was pretty sensitive area tonight, so I want you to stay alert and your boys alert. He said, you want to see something, Colonel? And yes, so I walked in the back room with him, and I looked at the end of the tarp up, and here was this body floating in some sort of liquid. And here was a strange thing. It was a small body. I thought it was a child first, and then I looked at the head and so forth, and the arms, and I saw it wasn't a child. It was a gray color. And then I put the tarp back down. Now, all this lasted, I say, 15 seconds or so.
15 seconds. Yeah. Long enough to recall details?
Or? I was an intelligence officer, and I was known to have a good retention on what I saw. So the face was, the head was large, but not as large as most drawings show. It was in large proportion to a small body.
Uh-huh.
No ears, no nose, no mouth, slits on me. And the eyes were large, slanted. Large compared to our eyes, but not great large eyes. The arms were sort of spindly and the legs were sort of spindly.
How big would you say this creature was?
Well, it wasn't even 5 feet tall. In fact, I thought it was a small child when I first saw it.
Okay.
And it sort of turned my stomach a little bit, but this was a normal reaction even in combat areas when I saw people more down by artillery firing. I get the same feeling. And usually you recover fast because you almost have to when you're in command of troops.
Sure.
And I recovered fast, and I figured, well, I don't know what it is. I can't evaluate it. So like a good intelligence officer, and I was trained by the British, by the way, I put it in the back of my head, and I figured someday, someplace, maybe I'll get cooperation and be able to evaluate this for what it is. And from then on, I forgot about it until something came out to bring it back.
Let me ask you one other question, Colonel. Surely you and the sergeant must have had a conversation.
I told the sergeant this. From Sergeant, get out of here, get out of this room, you could get in a lot of trouble. I'm the post-duty officer, I have all the clearance, of course, it's my duty to look around like this. But you're not supposed to be in here, so get out in the early, Sarge, in front of me.
Okay.
And that was okay. And then I asked him this question, a very important question. As we were walking out, from Sergeant, where did it come from? He said, well, I talked to the drivers. There was two men in each car, two soldiers in each truck. There were five trucks total. And he said that it came from some airfield in Fort Riley, they said, and they're heading for Lloyd Patterson Air Force Base. And that was all it was said. It came from Guard Roswell, or the base here. It said an Army Air Force Base in New Mexico. And that was all he told me.
Okay.
1947.
47, all right.
About 2 weeks after it happened here. And not long after, I was assigned that about a month before it in Fort Riley.
And this was in a veterinary office.
Well, we have veterinaries, and that's a logical place to keep some of this.
Sure. Sure. And so you just, after that experience, you just sort of filed it away for future reference.
Yes, sir. Because the intelligence process is collect, evaluate, collaborate, and then come forward with your report.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I did. I didn't know what it was. So I put it in the back of my head. And here's Linda back.
All right.
Art?
Yes.
I just wanted to help because the timelines here we need to stay on top of. That was 1947.
Right.
And I'm just going to, for just a moment, give some background that Colonel Philip Corso was a key Army intelligence officer who served on General MacArthur's staff in Korea and later on President Dwight D. Eisenhower's National Security Council as a lieutenant colonel.
Uh-huh.
During his 21-year military career, he was honored with 19 medals, decorations, and ribbons for meritorious service. He retired from the Army in 1963 after 3 extraordinary years from 1960 to 1963, working directly with Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau in the Pentagon, concerning this whole issue now from 47 to 1960, Colonel Corso had that one experience of seeing this extraterrestrial biological entity at Fort Riley on its way to Wright-Patterson. Now, let's jump to 1960, and for a moment, what I'd like to do is turn the phone...
Linda, we're right at the bottom of the hour.
Okay, and after we come back, I want William Burns to set the stage here for one of the most extraordinarily important points in United States history.
One other thing that I want to touch on, I put it on your list of things to ask. An obvious question, Linda, is after all those years, why is Colonel Corso coming forward now? And is his retirement threatened by doing so? I mean, an obvious question, and what kind of struggle he went through before he decided to write such a book. And
right, and it's exactly what I was leading to for Mr. Burns to explain how this could come about now and Colonel Corso not being in jeopardy.
Excellent. We will pick up on that point with William J. Burns when we return. I'm Art Bell. My guests are Linda Moulton Howe, Colonel Philip J. Corso, retired, and William J. Burns. And we'll all be right back. Go to Roswell, New Mexico. Linda?
Hi, Art.
Hi.
In the mid-80s, when I first heard that phrase, Earth Secret War, and what in the world was it about, I always thought that it was simply something of an inside unit in our government versus whatever the non-human intelligence was. But I'm beginning to understand in my conversations with Colonel Corso and William Burns is that it was a very much more complex and dicey situation in which the military was perceiving that they were having to operate as if not only did they not understand a non-human intelligence that Colonel Corso describes in his own book, they knew that there were animal mutilations and human abductions in the late 1950s, early 1950s, late 1940s, somewhere in that period, but they felt that they had to be concerned about, but they were also concerned about their Cold War enemies and this intense suspicion of spies in the Central Intelligence Agency and other agencies. And this sets the stage for the period of 1960 to 1963, and I'm going to read briefly from the book. In 1961, Colonel Corso, then a lieutenant colonel, was given command of one of the Pentagon's highly classified weapons development budgets and was made privy to the United States government's greatest secret, the dismantling and appropriation of the Roswell extraterrestrial spacecraft by the United States Army. Identifying all those involved, Colonel Corso revealed how a deep cover council officially discounted all UFO reports to the American public and cleared the path for his research and development team at the Pentagon to analyze and integrate the Roswell artifacts into the military arsenal and the private business sector. The extent of the operation is startling. With unprecedented detail, Colonel Corso divulges how he spearheaded the Army's reverse engineering project that seeded And that's S-E-E-D-E-D, like you would plant seeds. Seeded alien technology at American companies such as IBM, Hughes Aircraft, Bell Labs, and Dow Corning without their knowledge. He describes the devices found aboard the Roswell craft and how they were the precursors for today's integrated circuit chips, fiber optics, lasers, and super tenacity fibers. He also discusses the role alien technology played in shaping geopolitical policy and events. How it helped the United States surpass the Russians in space, spurred elaborate army initiatives such as SDI, which is the Star Wars program, Project Horizon, which we will talk about later in the program, but had to do with putting a base on the moon, Project HARP, that we have done shows on in the past, and ultimately brought about the end of the Cold War, unquote. I'm quoting from The Day After Roswell.
Right.
And now I am going to go to William J. Burns, the writer with Colonel Corso, to explain what was happening at the time that John F. Kennedy was president of the United States for a period of time before he was assassinated, and during those three crucial years. This is William Burns' analysis of this internecine warfare in the world picture.
All right.
Hi, Rod. How are you?
Mr. Burns, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
May I go back a little bit before we get going here and ask you how in the world Colonel Corso can now come forward or at any time can come forward and be safe?
First of all, Colonel Corso's relationships with the United States government intelligence community within the military are rock solid. He was an advisor to members of the Senate, an advisor to presidents, and an advisor to generals at the highest level of the military, and not just the Army, but obviously generals from other services as well shared in the intelligence that Colonel Corso had developed during the course of his career. So the very people that would be the ones who would look with great disfavor upon what Colonel Corso was doing were the ones who, during his tenure in office, and not just at the Pentagon, but at the Eisenhower White House, when he was a military commander in the most sensitive area of Europe, the Southern German Command, where he had authority to use field nuclear weapons, those very officers were the those very intelligence officers were the ones that he'd been putting in their places for 20 years. So no, they're not going to come forward now. This is a war that he's already showed who owns the battlefield on that one.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me his reasoning for coming forward? He must have struggled greatly with this before going public.
Yes and no. And when the time comes, I think the colonel himself is probably a more appropriate person to describe this, but I will tell you what he told me, and then a little later on we can hear from the colonel in his own words. Basically, the colonel belonged to a handful of officers led by, from the memoirs that I read of the man himself, written by the man himself, and the colonel's own memoirs, Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, who was probably one of the last of the great combat officers who had a grounding in military technology. I think it's a breed we don't have anymore. I don't want to speak for the present leadership, but I'm just saying that when you look at things like the War of the Generals and all the generals bumping heads in the Persian Gulf, and then you see a man like Arthur Trudeau, who during the Korean War, his men were trapped on Pork Chop Hill, and the orders came to abandon the men. Arthur Trudeau said, hell no, took off his general's helmet, put him on a sergeant's helmet, and said, who's coming up with me? Ran up the hill, took the man, brought him back down, put on his general's helmet, and that was it. Now, that's a hero.
Okay? You betcha. You betcha.
This is a man who fought the CIA, who was blasted by people like Dulles, and who came out on top every single time, and who led Army intelligence, and who completely reorganized the Army R&D inside the Pentagon, completely reorganized it to make what this book is about possible. So this man and the colonel were friends well after both men retired. General Trudeau went on to be a consultant to industry, had his own industrial consulting firm, worked, I think, for Gulf Oil in Pennsylvania. He was a good friend of the colonel's for many, many years afterwards. The two men had an oath. The oath was very simple. We will maintain our silence while we're both alive. When the general was sick, called the colonel aside, the two men, two old soldiers, you have to imagine the scene.
I can.
He said, I'm going to release you from your oath of silence. You can tell this story. And that was what it is. There was no national security oath, no great overriding concern of national security. This is what two men did inside the army. So this wasn't as though this was a great military strategy or a great defense strategy. This happened within the army with a handful of officers. Nobody else knew about it. That was the point. So there was no national security to breach.
All right, I understand. Now, to get to Linda's point of this war, I can fully understand that the military would not necessarily want the CIA or other intelligence agencies getting hold of this information, because over the years, we've seen I don't know how many spies caught, moles that have been passing information, were passing information, went to jail for it, to the then Soviet Union. So there's no question about that. I can understand why they would want to keep it out of the hands of the military. Is that accurate, or of the intelligence community?
That's accurate, Art. It is the very, very tip of the iceberg. It is only a micro sliver, a membrane sliver of what the real story is, which is much more frightening, much more horrifying, and when you realize how close this country came to nuclear war on a number of occasions because of bad intelligence, mistakes, and false assumptions, you realize how close to the edge we came. The real story starts even before the end of World War II with the OSS running around Europe, and with the penetration of the OSS even at that time. And this is not from Colonel Corso's own words. These are from words of CIA people themselves by NKVD units and Russian playback into our own intelligence services.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the military intelligence. This is the civilian intelligence services, and I want to draw that distinction very early in.
Right.
Military intelligence, Army G2, was separate and distinct from the civilian intelligence services, such as the OSS.
Understood.
Okay, now, so we knew, the Army knew, that even at the end of World War II, that the Germans had fallen into possession of some kind of extraterrestrial technology. The burst of strange German technology toward the end of the war was frightening. We knew that. We knew that from the scientists that we had retrieved from Germany. Colonel Corso happened to be one of the military officers who helped run Operation Paperclip when he was the area commander of Rome from 1944 to 1947, fighting off the rear guard Nazi Gestapo, SS units, and the Russian NKVD units posing as communist partisans. What were they after? It certainly wasn't Rome, though it was Mussolini's gold. What it was were whatever German secrets were available in Italy and Switzerland and the whole area at that time. And remember, there was another person coming into the scene working for the OSS at that time, Merle Berg, who also went through looking for whatever atomic secrets he could. Again, all documented, no big military secrets here. The secret is that Phil Corso was one of the people involved in the military end of Paperclip. The German scientists told the Army, told Corso, told Trudeau, told other people in the military, that the Germans had been in possession of extraterrestrial secrets. So the military intelligence end, as well as the OSS, as well as the Russians, as well as the British, knew that the Germans had stumbled upon a stockpile of some phenomenal technology. This is setting the stage for what happened in before the Roswell crash in 1947 with the split between the military and the civilian intelligence services when the National Security Act was passed under Truman, creating, in effect, the first fully functional, full-time civilian intelligence service, which operated under a black budget under the National Security Act, separate and distinct from direct and explicit congressional oversight. The Army, the Navy, potentially the Air Force, had intelligence services that were operated under congressional oversight and military oversight. They were operated in plain view, but this new service was totally secret. It was a secret government. What the Truman administration did not know was that prior to this creation of the superintelligence agency, its own command structure had been infiltrated by communist sympathizers. And I'm not saying this like some right-wing fanatic from the 1950s. I'm saying this as a narrative history, because the CIA officers themselves said this, had been infiltrated by communist sympathizers and in many instances, NKVD moles themselves. We created an intelligence service separate from congressional oversight, almost immune, operating with impunity, but had already been compromised, and nobody knew it except the military.
Mr. Burns, was there an operational name for this organization?
Well, originally, the organization was the Central Intelligence Group, the CIG, run by Admiral Roscoe Herrencutter. Remember his name, because where did Herrencutter turn up after the Roswell crash? It was the Central Intelligence Group, which eventually became the CIA.
Which began, okay.
As Colonel Corso was serving his time as a range officer, commanding a missile battalion in White Sands, then going to the most sensitive area of Germany, then serving as Inspector General, toward the end of the Eisenhower administration, there was a restructuring going. General Truman reorganized entire Army R&D after he left G2, and this began in 1959. Linda correctly suggests that G2 is Army intelligence, and Lieutenant General Trudeau was the commander of intelligence. He reorganized R&D. Remember, he was an engineer, and so he reorganized Army R&D when he took over in 1959. The colonel who's a scholar on Army R&D, on the history of this, will tell you that originally Army R&D had a minor function under logistics.
Mm-hmm.
Even General Twining himself, again a name we remember from the Roswell crash, had suggested that the study of UFOs, and this is his words, not mine, the study of flying saucers, the analysis of what it is, be given to foreign technology under R&D. This is what Twining himself said all the way back after 1947 and in the early 50s. But Army R&D, military R&D, wasn't up to snuff. Not until General Trudeau reorganized it in 69. He had requested when 59, Colonel Corso, correct me, when the colonel came back to the United States after his tour of duty in Germany, General Trudeau requested that in 1961, he report to the Pentagon. This is shortly after the inauguration of John F. Kennedy. He report to the Pentagon to take over. The situation was, however, that by the time the colonel arrived at the Pentagon, it had become even more urgent. The Army was sitting on material that had been basically housed in the Pentagon. In some way, shape, or form for 14 years.
Mr. Burns, there's a couple of things I'm unclear.
Go ahead.
One is an astounding revelation that the Germans had, you're suggesting the Germans had alien technology before we did.
What I'm suggesting is that the Germans themselves told us that they had alien technology before the end of World War II, yes.
And that would have been prior to our acquisition of any of that.
That's correct. Hermann Oberth, who was on Colonel Corso's, both with his ad hoc brain trust inside R&D, told the colonel directly that the Germans had that technology.
Do we know how they acquired it?
I just want to put one thing in here. It was Hermann Oberth who was referenced in the very important Keyhole book as having knowledge of researching where the source of this non-human intelligence might be. It was Hermann Oberth who was talking to Kehoe right from that whole period of time that Kehoe wrote about, and if everybody would go back and read Kehoe books, they would begin to see that the pattern of what Colonel Corso and William Burns are describing right now is laid out in another direction.
All right, but my question is this, and maybe we can get a simple answer. It is suggested or said that the Germans had alien technology before we did. And my question is simply, can anybody describe to me how the Germans acquired that? Or do we simply know they have it and we don't know how they got it?
I'll tell you just one brief thing and then I'll turn it over to Burns again. That I was told by people during that 83-84 time period when I was working on that HBO project and after that meeting with Doty at Kirtland, that the story went back to 1937, that the Germans had retrieved either a craft or portions of a craft with technology that our government was extremely concerned about, of proving exactly what was retrieved by the Germans and under what conditions. I do not know the details, and I'm going to turn it back to Mr. Burns to make a comment, and then we'll go to the colonel.
All right. So, imagine the stage being set. The Army knows the Germans have utilized alien technology. The Army retrieved alien technology from the crash at Roswell in 1947. Nothing at all was done with it. Maybe there was some furtive attempts from the original storehouse at Wright Field to try to farm it into industry to analyze this, but nothing formal, no plan, no strategy. Something else was happening in the late 1950s as well, and the early 1960s, during this period. It was that the FBI had been receiving strange reports of abductions. Now, when you look at this logically from a law enforcement perspective, where would reports of abductions normally go? I mean, you certainly wouldn't go running around under too many psychiatrists. People would think you're crazy.
Yes.
But people who reported being taken from their homes called the police. Well, that's a federal crime. So the police would turn it over to the FBI. So the FBI, this spooked the hell out of Dan Gruber, the FBI begins compiling reports in an organized way on abductions. They're not saying alien abductions. They're not saying UFOs. They're not saying flying saucers.
In other words, at this point, the FBI doesn't know what the hell's going on.
No, they don't know what's going on. That's the whole point.
All right.
This is a complete cloud of unknowing.
All right, Ms. Burns, we're at the top of the hour. Everybody gets to rest for a while. We'll recoup and start again after the news. Stay right there. Oof. Colonel Philip J. Corso retired, William J. Burns, and Linda Howe are my guests from Roswell.
From the Kingdom of Nye, we continue with your calls on Dreamland with Art Bell.
Hi, Linda. Okay, good.
Art, before we go to Colonel Corso to describe exactly what these physical artifacts were in these file cabinets in General Trudeau's offices that Colonel Corso was then given the assignment by the general to try to get into the military-industrial complex research and development projects, I would like William Burns to just go into the details of the relationship a little bit more between the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and the Central Intelligence Agency when John F. Kennedy became president in 1960, and a few months later is when Philip Corso was in the Pentagon talking with General Trudeau about what they had to do in one of the most incredible situations of this internecine warfare within our own government, and here is William Burns to help explain this.
So the stage is set now that it's 1960, and you've got this split between the civilian intelligence services, basically the CIA, which had been penetrated by the KGB and was really pumping out through false estimates of intelligence a Communist Party line, a Soviet line. You have the military, which knows about this, and you have some senators and government people in the know and some not in the know. At this point, you've got reports of these strange abductions reaching the FBI. Hoover absolutely does not trust the CIA, and in fact, Art, you may know, many of the listeners may know, that as early as the late 1940s, there was a shooting war going on between the CIA and the FBI over spying and over the running of drugs right after the end of the war. So there was no love lost between these agencies. At the very same time, these strange reports of cattle and animal mutilations began reaching the local sheriff's departments, because they're not doing these things in the middle of New York City.
Sure.
Where are they? They're out in the west. They're on farmland. They're on cattle ranches.
You bet.
Sheriffs get these reports. What do? They begin compiling them, turning them over to the state departments of public safety in places like Texas, Colorado, Wyoming. Eventually, they reach the FBI. What is the FBI supposed to do? Well, when they go to the CIA for help, it's like throwing something into a bottomless pit. Nothing comes out, and the agencies aren't talking to each other anyway.
Right.
But the Army begins compiling these reports, because where else can the FBI go? It is now the spring of 19. It is now just after January in 1961. There is a full-scale war going on inside the Beltway between the civilian intelligence, i.e. the CIA, and the military intelligence. The three military services, Army, Navy, Air Force, all have their own separate R&D divisions. Trudeau effectively organizes the Army into the most powerful R&D division that exists, and this, in the midst of this warfare, is where Colonel Corso comes to begin his stint as the Director of Foreign Technology, the very same division named by Nathan Twining a decade earlier to be the repository of the alien artifacts.
Whew.
JFK and RFK have just taken office, a completely new administration. They are not well-liked by the intelligence community. They are not well-liked because they are obviously very fraternal. And remember, they come to power. This administration comes to power under a cloud of suspicion to begin with because of the whole Cook County vote and what happened in the final hours of the electoral count to get them into office in the first place. Lyndon Johnson, as you know, also made many, many political deals to gain favor in the Senate and to reach power, and the Johnson family became very, very powerful in Texas, strong ties to the FBI. So this is an administration which comes in under a real cloud of suspicion.
All right.
Okay?
All right. And so that sets the stage. And now, from Colonel Corso, I presume, we should ask what he found in these General Trudeau's cabinets.
Okay, well, before we even get to that, remember, the first thing that JFK and RFK are faced with when they reach office is they are dealing with the information coming to support the Bay of Pigs.
Right.
So they immediately run afoul of the CIA in the very early days of the administration because they pull back from the Bay of Pigs, infuriate the emigre Cuban community in the United States, but also infuriate the whole civilian intelligence apparatus.
I'm sure.
And when he removed Alan Dulles from the CIA, a long time political hand in government, he also further angers the CIA, and the war is now exacerbated, and that's what happens, Colonel Corso.
Well, the only word I would think of would be betrayal. They would feel betrayed.
That's right, and they're betrayed, and at the center of this whole warfare is the stockpile of information and technology retrieved from Roswell sitting in the Pentagon.
All right.
And here, Art, is Colonel Corso to describe what he physically saw handled in these file drawers in General Trudeau's office.
All right. Colonel Corso.
Yeah, I'm on now.
Welcome back. All right. They have set the stage well, and so there you are, working for General Trudeau. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what did you find, and how did... your own words, sir.
Yeah. Well, just let me go back a little bit. When General Trudeau said he was going to send for me, he told me this. He came over to visit in Germany. And when I came back, he sent for me. The chief of personnel called me. And I went into General Trudeau, and I saluted him. He said, "You on board, Phil?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Watch things for me, Phil. The rest don't understand." And it was what Bill Burns has just described to you, what he meant, really. So he made me his special assistant. Then about... I'd say a week or 10 days passed, and I was appointed Foreign Technology Division. When I moved in the Foreign Technology Division, just shortly after that, General Trudeau called me and said, "I'm delivering a file cabinet to you." He said, you go through it, and you start working up a plan of action and recommendations to me.
Without telling you what was in it?
No, he didn't tell me what was in it.
Oh, boy.
And later on, he used to joke a lot when he'd come into my office and he'd say, where's Corso's junk file or his nut file? Because the items actually were on my desk and they looked like I picked them out of a waste basket or something. And he used to kid about that, but then he'd also get serious and say, Bill, they could change our lives, let's change the world. In one particular case, I didn't talk to the gentleman. I had the integrated circuit chips are about like a quarter. And I mentioned to him, I told him, General, what's going to happen in the future if this chip, which was one of our most important thing we had, I'd say number one just about, ever integrates with the human brain? And he looked, he said, yes, Phil, that's a great danger. But let's hope the people come after us will understand. He said, but I doubt if it'll happen in our lifetime. Well, he died, and I'm still here, and and they're working on that now. Now, in addition to that, when I started to go through the file, I found the first thing I had was a piece of metal about the size of a postcard,
mm-hmm.
and paper thin, but the atoms were lined in it, and this came from Livermore Lab, which is one of the laboratories we financed up at MIT. And he called me in, and he said, I'm making you head of a team. You will get in Army engineers and even the German scientists. And I did assign two to my team. And they worked with me. So the job was to go around the industry, the first job, and see who was working on such items. So we did. We started to go to industry.
In other words, IBM, the big ones, who were working on...
We went to... These came in other factors. This particular one I'm talking about is a line of atoms. So one day when we went to one of these industries and they had a long thing, tunnel-like thing, and at the end of the day, right after supper, I motioned to one of the German engineers, German scientists. I told him, Hans, take a walk with me.
Uh-huh.
I went to walk and I told him, well, what do you think? He said, Colonel, if I believe everything I've heard today, I have to unlearn everything I've ever learned. So I told him, Hans, you might have to. He just stopped. He said, I'll remember what you said. So from then on, Nino Trudeau, when he assigned me as head of that team, made the statement, this could be bigger than Los Alamos, because it can make spaceships light as a feather, can be penetrated by radiation, cosmic action. No gunshots can penetrate it.
You're referring to the metal.
Piece of metal yet, I'm still there. So, we worked on that, but I have to end with a note on that piece of metal. We didn't succeed as much as we tried, and we were, well, and he gave me instructions, if you think they're beginning the process, fund it.
Well, in other words, let me be straight, Colonel. You took this to a private corporation,
yes.
And you in essence said, can you duplicate this, or can you make this, or can you back engineer it? And they tried and failed.
Yeah, well, let's say we all failed. We tried it. We financed it even. We never did. Anybody we assigned it to or we thought was getting close to it, never happen.
All right, this piece of metal came from where? The crash at Roswell, or did you not know?
No, I knew it. The file I had the papers with it describing it.
And where did it come from?
It came from Roswell.
Roswell.
Now, then we moved to the integrated circuit, the size of a chip. Then General Trudeau gave me instructions. Find out who in the industry is working on similar, like the transistors already started.
Right.
He said, any scientists are working on it, write me a plan of action on how we're going to do all this. So I finally came up with my plan and gave it to him. He okayed it. That we would find scientists and people who were working in that area, particular area, and we would infuse in there normal research and development proposals. Not the item itself, but proposals describing it. These are supposed to be normal R&D think tank type operations.
In other words, you would come up with a proposal that would suggest, for example, What about the concept of developing an integrated circuit, an IC circuit?
Yes.
Miniaturized.
Yes, along that line we came up. And
how did you get that kernel to the
file.
To the industry leaders?
To the Edward Trudeau started the program, what we call Applied Engineering. And even Dr. Teller was in on that, and he's still alive, you know.
Right.
And this Applied Engineering, here's exactly what we did. We found out people working in that area. We infused the technology in this through R&D projects, and we funded it. They didn't use our money. We funded the project.
And
then every time we thought they were slowing down, we would infuse maybe a little more, and then finally the chip went over to them.
All of this black budget money?
No, this is not black budget. This was R&D money.
R&D money?
Given to us. This was money appropriated by Congress.
All right.
We had in addition to that, let me tell you this since you asked about budget. There's such a thing as R&D T&E operation. That was research, development, and add T&E, yes. And these type of programs were that the first item made, we would go and check where it was done. Well, it was T, so it's for test evaluation. I better add that on.
Yes, sir.
The first budget that came in was the prototype. And I tell them, when the first prototype was off the line, I'll be there to check it.
You bet.
Many times it wasn't. And I even threatened sometimes. I had authority to cancel contracts. Now, since the first item, an RDT&E, was still under R&D, and we financed that with our budget. Again, not a black budget, an open budget.
Understood.
Voted by Congress.
Yes.
Because remember, the projects that went out were normal research and development contracts.
Makes sense, yes.
They weren't sub-rosa or anything like that.
Right.
Or any say, we can't tell you enough. We put them out in that sense. And this program started to operate. And it started pretty good. Then one day, I pulled out of the file a bunch of wires. Well, I thought they were wires, and they were emitting colors. And there was some sort of, there must have been some sort of circuit in there or some sort of power source. I had no idea what it was. I didn't know if it was a wire, it was a selling plastic. But finally we got, there's people working on similar time. In fact, lately I talked to some scientists who were in that area. And this was infused in, and I think one of the ones that was used in was Bell Laboratory. From that, fiber optics developed.
Fiber optics?
Yes. Now, also, let me get back to a little story on the chip, on the integrated circuit.
All right, may I stop you and ask you, the material in those filing cabinets, was that all from Roswell?
It was from Roswell, but I got idea that some of it maybe came from the St. Augustine crash out here.
All right. Anyway, you were going back to the chip.
Yeah, I'm going back to the chip now. That was one of our really the number one imports. I found in my file, a file I had in there that was labeled Project Rainbow.
Rainbow.
Project Rainbow was von Neumann's, John von Neumann's project. And I read it, and this was amazing. He was starting to work on artificial intelligence, artificial life.
Oh, my.
And I put it aside, and I locked down to look back. Was I remiss? I had the organization, the money, the brain work, the brain people would do it. And I didn't. I put it away because I really didn't understand it, to tell you the truth. I didn't understand everything that I had. In fact, many times I thought, we weren't that brilliant.
How did you even decide where to take any item that you might have plucked?
Here's what happened. General Trudeau made it a point to contact most of the industries in the Fortune 500.
Right.
He personally went to visit 25 of the boards. In fact, to give you a little story, I went with him to Sperry Rand. We met the board. In fact, who came out and met us? Martha herself.
Right.
He was chairman of the board up for. I thought myself and General Trudeau, that was a great honor when MacArthur came out to see us, although I served under him in Korea. Stages. But it had to progress. For example, General Trudeau told me one day, getting back to the integrated circuit, he said, Phil, the transistor in the way it is today and the integrated circuit took us 5 years to develop. It should have taken 250 years. Now, those were his exact words to me. Now, von Neumann's project, maybe one of the reasons I did look confused and we couldn't do it, was really the supercomputer had not come in existence then. It did come in existence to late years now.
Right.
So we were, and maybe I had some intuition not to fund this and start it because we really were not in permission to exploit this and develop it. Supercomputers had not been developed at that stage, but they were working on it. Then I'll tell you another interesting little story. I had what we called a super tenacity fiber. It looked like string, but you couldn't burn it, you couldn't cut it with a razor blade, and we found out that the atom structure was aligned in them.
That the what? The atom structure?
Yes. Atomically aligned, just like the piece of metal.
Just like the metal.
Now, that is a strange little story here, an interesting little story. So where did we find the nearest thing on this earth to that was a spider web. The spider spins an atomically aligned web.
All right, Colonel, Colonel, hold it right there for a moment. We're going to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. My, oh my. Colonel Philip J. Corso retired, along with William J. Burns, who co-authored The Day After Roswell, and of course, Linda Moulton Howe. I'm Art Bell from an area near Dreamland. This is Dreamland. Talk Back Live. The older members of the audience were nodding their heads in approval, while the younger people appeared to be rolling their eyes in disbelief. To understand the Roswell cover-up, the reasons why it took years for individuals like Colonel Corso to come forward, you have to examine the facts in the context of post-war America. On this Independence Day weekend, I salute Colonel Corso and wish him well. I'm sure he must have agonized before coming forward. Colonel?
It's me, Art, and I couldn't agree with your words more. He is truly an American hero, along with General Trudeau and many others at that period of time when it was so difficult to know exactly what to do with all the complexities we're talking about tonight. And before the Colonel continues with his fascinating story of the government's, his R&D interest in the spider web, I wanted to quote from his book. And this had to do with the autopsies on the creatures that were retrieved from some crash somewhere in New Mexico. The medical report revealed that the creatures were enclosed within a one-piece protective covering like a jumpsuit or outer skin in which the atoms were aligned so as to provide a great tensile strength and flexibility. One examiner wrote that it reminded him of a spider's web, which appears very fragile but is in fact very strong.
Linda?
Yeah.
It sounds an awful lot like the aliens depicted in Independence Day.
Well, these are the outer garments.
I understand. But
yeah.
If you recall, on Independence Day, they had an outer...
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, you're right. Yes. And how much of fiction is actually copying nonfiction because of leaks, we'll probably never know. But you're right. You're making a very good point. Well, the unique qualities of a spider web result from the alignment of fibers that provide great tenacity because they're able to stretch under great pressure, yet display a resiliency that allows them to snap back into shape even after the shock of an impact. Similarly, the creature's spacesuit or outer skin appeared to be stretched around it as if it were literally spun over the creature and seized up around it, providing a perfect skin-tight protective fit. The doctors had never seen anything like it before, unquote. And now here is Colonel Corso to continue this exploration of spiderweb tenacity.
Oh, I'm back on.
Yes, Colonel. Welcome back.
Now, finish the spiderweb story. These spiderwebs, you could stretch them for miles. They had like a hook-type arrangement when they were spun. It was a line, and it would stretch. You could stretch it for miles, not break it, then it would snap back in place. So that what we did, because of its strength and tenacity in the way it all, we made flak jackets out of it.
Flak jackets.
And they worked very well. But the problem was we couldn't get enough spider web. So we gave a contract out, the first one I remember, and this, by the way, appeared in the Discovery Magazine story not too long ago, which I cut out. We financed the University of Wyoming. We wanted them to try to clone the spider. that...
I'm sorry, I missed that. Colonel, you wanted them to what?
Clone the spider.
Oh, clone the spider.
So we could get enough material to make flight jackets.
Understood.
But we never succeeded, and they never succeeded until today. I don't think it's been done. So we had to go to other fibers like Kevlar and everything, the way the flight jackets are made today.
Yes. Yeah, but it all began with that file drawer material.
Yes, that came out of my file drawer.
May I ask a question, Colonel, that jumps way ahead?
Sure.
What happened to all the material that was in that file drawer? Where is that material now?
Well, really, I don't know. Some people have asked me at times, did you keep any? You could have kept some and made millions. I said, wait a minute. I was an Army officer.
That belonged to me. I understand.
That was the Army's.
So, in other words...
I'm the one that... And intelligence and sovereign security, the one that should keep the people from stealing things from the Army.
I understand. So when you left, you wouldn't have any idea of its chain of custody?
No, I just turned it back over. Just like, I can tell you this, I didn't know the chain of custody even before I got it. So I never, and then actually when I retired, I wasn't even in the Army anymore, and I have no idea today. I asked some officers not too long ago that I know to try to keep it quiet, and I told them, where I thought the file could be, but it's up to somebody else to track it down because I can't do it. I'm not in the Army anymore.
Uh-huh.
And here's the...
Art.
Yes.
Just one of the other units or pieces in this amazing file cabinet that Colonel Corswell had, in the book, he raises this. He said, why did the inhabitants of the craft have a cutting device that when they... had it, they could see that there was some kind of a red dot coming out of a black piece that they had, one of these file cabinet technologies they did not understand, and
yes.
They didn't know what it was. And finally, one time that they saw some smoke in the room, and suddenly they could see this red beam of light, and of course what I'm describing is what we now know as a laser.
Didn't
know. And he said, why did the inhabitants of this craft have a cutting device like this aboard their ship? It wasn't until later when I read military reports of cattle mutilations in which entire organs were removed without any visible trauma to the surrounding cell tissue that I realized that the light beam cutting torch I thought was in the Roswell file was actually a surgical implement, just like a scalpel that was being used by the aliens in medical experiments on our livestock, unquote. I would like now to turn the phone back to Colonel Corso to describe his first handling of this device.
Well, my first handling was, I had another device that was similar to this one. And of course, like a human doesn't know any better, I figured the batteries are dead. I couldn't turn it on. And there was no batteries in it. But that was the first reaction of a typical reaction of a human that doesn't know anything.
Would have been mine.
Yeah. And later on, well, it was mine, too, and I was in charge. But later on, like the other little instrument I had, which I think measured the intensity of brain waves on different organs of the body,
uh-huh.
That particular thing, I thought the battery was dead in that also. Then I took it to a lab down at Belvoir. And lo and behold, when some radiation area, I went in, the thing came on.
When you went into an area where there was radiation?
Well, there was actually, we had the low-level radiation because that was our atomic lab, the one we kept that they didn't take away from us.
And so when it got into that area, it turned on?
It turned on. Of course, it had graduated things, and I shipped that to Monmouth also because they were our electronic labs.
Yes, sir.
And there, it was an R&D project because they were our labs and they were military thing. And I never did get a, because I left after, not too long after, when General Trudeau retired, and 6 months later I did. But I shipped it to them, and that was those two interesting little items. And the laser, then the second most important thing after the circuit that I think we did was our development on lasers. A lot of people believe that the laser was started before. Well, there were experiments before, yes, way back. But the thing blossomed and took hold on lasers in 1960, and even General Beach, who took General Trudeau's place, made that remark in public.
When you turned that device over?
I turned them over to Monmouth, electronic labs.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, not
on Long Island, yes.
They were our electronic labs. And then also...
Did you then follow the progress of the back engineering?
Well, yes, I followed them for a time, but then... Now, also another thing, I better inject this right now. Much as it seems now when they read the book and all, that people think how important they're seeking, this was not my primary job. This was like a secondary job.
What was your primary job?
Well, my primary job was special assistant chief R&D, for example, budgets. And I was the first project officer on the anti-missile missile. Trudeau assigned that to me, the importance of it, because the brain from the extraterrestrial had four lobes that could integrate back and forth electromagnetically. And we did similar work out on our ICBMs, International Continental Missiles. So we did that, and we used these items on that. We went along that line. And then, I'll jump ahead a little bit, we had what we call, a laser developed into, we had to be very careful with that weapon we developed, which really got into Star Wars. Actually, the weapon, your weapon, could go 300,000 kilometers a second, an airplane traveling the speed of sound, there was no lead time. I think they calculated they would travel 1 millimeter before the ray hit it.
Weapon was this?
New weapon. Direct energy weapon.
Direct energy weapon.
We had to be careful. It was dangerous. One doctor, he wrote an article that I have a copy of, a little paragraph. He said, the most frightening thing in my life happened to me. My eyes popped out and started to bleed inside. He said, I've never had such a frightening experience, and it came from looking at the ray. So we had to be careful with these things, too, because we didn't know what it would do altogether. So this was what was later developed in the Dew weapon. And also we found out a very serious thing during that period. In fact, the project officer took my place in as a special projects officer of the anti-missile. He came to me one day and he said, Phil, he was a colonel too. He said, we got an awful thing. We better. And he said, the Soviets can change the trajectory of their ICBM missiles in midair. So, my God, we better go to Trudeau, the general, right now. Mm-hmm. And that was almost a little frightening because if we couldn't hit him, look at the danger we were in.
Of course.
So that became a crash project. And the answer was really the Dew weapon.
Direct energy.
Because it could get so fast, so quick on the target.
That it wouldn't matter how it moved.
You couldn't evade it. Like our radars, like the radars I had at Red Canyon here in White Sands on my Nike missiles, we had a pencil beam that could lock on.
Colonel, was this some sort of electromagnetic pulsing weapon?
It came from the laser family, let's put it this way.
Uh-huh.
I have the pamphlets. The pamphlets I have at the Army send me, non-classified, I have them with me. They're all dated 1961, 62, and 63. So that's, and then also there was another thing which I tell you happened. This is an interesting little story. I have a pamphlet written by General Britton, head of Army Material Command, in 1963. On the front page, there's a photograph of a cart we built, three-wheeled cart.
Yes.
This three-wheeled cart, we took the integrated circuit in it, and instead of putting electricity in it, we put water in them. The cart ran on water. And when I told Senator Glenn this, he got so interested I had to give him the photograph and told him, Senator, it was right up here at Harry Diamond Lab in North Park, Washington, Adelphia. Maybe you can call him and go up and see it if it's still there.
A process, was it utilizing hydrogen from water?
Water.
Yes, but the hydrogen from the water.
Well, I don't know if it broke down to that. It was still liquid. It didn't turn to gas.
Didn't turn to gas.
And I gave it to Senator Glenn. In fact, that particular meeting I had with Senator Glenn, there was an interesting comment that comes out of that. I asked the senator, and I think he'll verify because I had the appointment for half an hour, and he'd spend an hour and a half with me, and he had people waiting. I mentioned flying saucers to him. And he saw his mind. He said, you know, Colonel, I'm an agnostic. I told him, the senator, you didn't say you don't believe. And he laughed. And so that was. And then for the first time, I sent to the Army Historical Branch Engineers, and I told them where it was and what it was. And if they'd look it up and send me a copy, this was Project Horizon, the military colony on the moon, which we did in 1959.
A military colony on the moon.
It's the appendix. 50 pages of it is the appendix in my book. In fact, the first moon lander, there's a photograph of it in there. We did that. We had some of the best brains in the country, I think, worked on it, Von Braun scientists and all. And when defense found out that, and they took the civilian top, took everything away from us and organized NASA, they killed it on us. We were never able to do anything on it. I declassified for General Trudeau, and it lay there in the files for years.
But what you're suggesting, Colonel, is that we had spacecraft and the ability to colonize the moon, which you're saying we did, and at the same time we were developing a space program that, as compared to it, was like a Model A to a modern
BMW. The forerunner of the Gemini and the other satellite. And lately, a friend of mine, a scientist, met with Atlanta, with the NASA's top people, and he threw Project Horizon, the 310 pages, on the table, and they were flabbergasted. After all these years, it was dead in the files until I pulled. In fact, if you look in the appendix of the book, in the front page of Horizon, you'll see right on top where it's secret and it's crossed off. The secret is crossed off because I declassified that for the general. And this is the first appearance it makes in public.
Project Horizon. And that went on for how many years?
Well, they killed it on us in about 1961. The Department of Defense just said nothing doing, no appropriation, nothing, forget it.
Could it have continued, Colonel, without your knowledge?
It didn't continue. No, I had knowledge. I had, no, you know, although I retired from the Army, I had friends there. We trusted each other. We talked many times. I lived in Arlington, Virginia. I was close by. I saw these boys. No, it did not continue.
Why would a project capable of putting a colony on the moon not continue?
Well, I think Bill Burns testified that there was a battle of territory or whatever you want to call it, of appropriations. So there was a terrific battle going on inside the government which people didn't know about. And this thing, let's say, got caught in the battle. They didn't like the Army. They didn't like us, the civilian heads. And out of the military, you know, they didn't like us very much, and they wanted to pull us down. Anything we did was try to take it away from us. And unfortunately, this project with the moon lander in there, a picture of the moon lander, it's in there. They just destroyed it on us. They made us quit. Stop. You got orders of no more.
God.
And the project died. And there's all the photographs. In fact, right here, she has right in her hand a book. Now, what's the page number?
Colonel, why don't you hand the phone to Linda Howe for just one moment, if you will, sir.
Okay, Linda.
All right.
Linda, two things very quickly. One, I'm trying to make sense of all this. The electromagnetic, the direct energy weapon he mentioned.
Right.
In my mind, might translate to an electromagnetic pulsing weapon. And as you know, in STS 48 and 80, we see things occurring that look very much like an electromagnetic pulsing weapon.
Right.
Point one. Point two, I'm finding it very hard to understand how a project that colonized the moon prior to as our space program was just getting off the ground, could have possibly been dropped, even with budget wars going on, using that technology to have done all that and then just drop the project?
Yes, and I'm going to, in just a few minutes, I'm going to transfer this back to Mr. Burns to explain that art, but I want you to hear excerpts from the actual, now unclassified, by Colonel Corso. This is a paragraph signed by Arthur G. Trudeau.
About 1 minute, Linda.
Chief of Research and Development in the Pentagon. I envision expeditions development of the proposal to establish a lunar outpost to be of critical importance to the United States Army of the future. This evaluation is apparently shared by the Chief of Staff in view of his expeditious approval and enthusiastic endorsement of initiation of the study, which said there is a requirement for a manned military outpost on the moon. The lunar outpost is required to develop and protect potential United States interests on the moon, to develop techniques in moon-based surveillance of the Earth and space, in communications relay and in operations on the surface of the moon, to serve as a base for exploration of the moon, for further exploration into space,
and for military operations on the moon if required, and to support scientific investigations on the moon.
All right,
when we come back, we'll have...
Linda, I need to understand. Did the colonel say that we actually did that, went to the moon?
Oh, no.
Only that it was proposed based on the technology we were developing or trying to develop?
Yeah, General Trudeau wanted this done, and this was all drawn up as a plan, and it was going forward like an extension of General Trudeau's getting these artifacts.
I understand. I understand. I'm glad.
And suddenly, the rug was pulled out from under them.
Okay. I've got it. Thank you, Linda.
He said, Phil, I asked him a question. He looked at me and said, I know what you want, but Victor, do you want me killed?
Well, that would indicate then they had some
similar thing.
You betcha.
Yes.
All right. Colonel, I can't let this interview end without asking you, at the end of your first interview, the exclusive interview you did with Dateline,
yes.
You made a comment about a time machine. And they seem to use that comment of yours as a way to almost try and discredit, you know, the commentators sort of rolled his eyes, to sort of discredit everything else you had said. So I've got to ask you about that. May I ask you about that?
Yes. Well,
what did you mean?
In the book, there's a part in there where I discussed this with Professor Obert. We discussed time travel. But it was a discussion in those days about the possibility of time travel. And even the British were working on this. I had some documents and things I looked at, but they weren't. And then if you go back to the Philadelphia experiment,
yes, sir.
There were some ramifications in there which something disappeared and moved in space. And even Einstein's theories talk about zero travel time in his theories. And that was very unfortunate. When I was at the White House, I didn't go up and see Einstein. I should have. And I missed out on talking to the greatest mind that ever lived. Awesome. And then I also discussed this with Wilbur Smith, the Canadian genius, who was treated very badly by his government, and he brought us also a piece of metal. So as far as that, these factors that I just said enter into this. But the main item was that I did discuss this with Herman Obert, and Obert thought himself, now not me because I didn't know that much about it,
uh-huh.
His opinion was that it is possible.
That time travel is possible.
That was Herman Obert.
So the reference
much more brilliant than I was.
So then the reference to time travel was, it's something I'll tell you about, and you would have said what you just now said, not that you saw or traveled in time or saw a time machine or anything like it.
Never traveled in time. I wish I could. I'd like to do that.
All right. I'm glad we cleared
that up.
In fact,
lately I had an operation in my stomach. I had a ES hernia, and the doctor pulled it down, a good friend of mine. Now I can eat apple pie and ice cream at night and go to sleep like a baby.
Uh-huh.
And I told him, Doc, what'd you do? Push me back 40 years younger? And I haven't been able to do that in 40 years. So maybe I did travel back a little bit.
Well, medically.
I'd like very much to travel in time if I could.
Well, I'm glad to have cleared that up because they were using that to discredit you.
Yeah, they did. But they didn't ask him. They had so much good material they never used. I can't understand that. But that's their business. They're in the business and I'm not. So they were free to use what they did.
Were you... When you got to see the interview, sir, after it was all done and when it aired, were you surprised at what did not air?
No, I was not, because I had testified before the MIA committees, and I stood in front of Senator Curry and Senator McMahon and others, and I told them, now the interview that I did when I talked to President Eisenhower on the prisoner issue, we agreed to cover the intelligence aspect on the spies that they were feeding back, taking our boy's identity, and then getting the Russian to adopt that identity and sending back this here to the States as a spy. We agreed that, but President Eisenhower never told me to cover the prisoners going to Russia. In fact, he gave me permission to put out the numbers, which I did in Associated Press and speeches I wrote for Lodge at the United Nations. Yet the newspapers took the sensational thing that Eisenhower hid the prisoner going to Russia from the families.
Of course.
That never happened. So I had a little experience in this type of reporting.
I understand. Colonel, earlier I asked your co-author, Ms. Burns, Bill Burns, what kind of agony and thought process you went through before you came forward with all of this incredible information.
It wasn't really agony. Let me explain what I, how, why I decided to write the book.
Please.
First thing, easy to explain, I had an oath with the general. An honorable, honest, good man. I was an Army officer. I wasn't about to break my oath to him. And he released me from the oath, he said, when he died. 3 years ago, unfortunately, he died. I was released from my oath. Then I could talk if I wanted to.
Uh-huh.
I'm criticized by my own son and family. He said, 35 years, you didn't even tell us.
Sure.
Why should I tell you? I had an oath. And one day my grandchildren asked me, said, Granddad, what did you do during the war? I figured I'd better start putting this on paper and at least leave them a legacy. From that, as I was writing my experiences, it evolved into what we have now. And that's how it came about. And that's really the story, a very simple story.
But this
I didn't go through any agony or anything. No one has ever told me not to talk.
I understand, but this is such incredible information that surely you must have at least considered the impact on society.
Yes.
Really,
General Trudeau told me one day, Phil, you and I go from one development to the other, and we take it as a matter of course in our daily work,
yes.
And we think nothing of it. Yes, some of these things are earth-shaking. These were General Trudeau's words. So we had to learn to live with that type of thinking. And it was the same as almost like thinking in combat. You have to live with it. I tell people, I can tell you what it was like, but I can't tell you how it felt. You have to be there yourself.
How much of the material, Colonel, that was in those file cabinets was developed into products we use today, percentage-wise, versus how much we couldn't, was in there that we simply couldn't do anything with?
Very little. I'd say that we've developed maybe less than 5%. We developed some very important things now for the world.
So in other words, somewhere, there's still a lot of material that somebody's working very hard on.
Exactly. I think there is. Because, like Mr. Burns said, a flying saucer itself is a capacitor. And the reason a lot of them have crashed have been trying to build because they miss out that the extraterrestrial is really the guide system. He blends with the capacitor.
God, I've heard that from so many sources.
Yeah, and we came to that conclusion also. In fact, I think one of the greatest things that we were remiss that we didn't do more work to study this clone or this creature or whatever he is. We should have done a lot more. We should have diagnosed him and studied it minutely.
So there were actually those eye covers in the cabinet as well, and that's what led to night vision goggles.
Yes, it was actually the third eyelid. It was like something like a camel. You know, he has another eyelid which blocks the sand out.
Yes,
it was similar. So we have something similar in this world. Well, this in here, remember, these creatures walked around in the dark. You know, how could they see in the dark if they didn't have something like that? My boys. And one of the requirements when I went to the night vision lab is make a night vision device which can fit over the soldier's eye almost like goggles.
Yes.
Not something bulky and big which he can't wear. And has to carry, he has to put it on. A soldier operates in combat. He can't be carrying everything looking through it out around. You see, so, and they did. They did it. I have a pamphlet that they wrote. And I give them credit. They did perform and made it. And it was our whole laboratory that did it, too.
All right, Colonel. We've got to hold it there for a moment. Stand by. We'll get back to you. Colonel Philip J. Corso. You know, it's hard to know what to say to this kind of information, except... Oh, my God.
This is documented. Again, people said, oh, who is this guy saying this? Who is this guy, Corso? They found in the National Archives that everything that Corso was saying was documented in black and white, and it's at the Eisenhower Library even today. So there you are. You've got a civilian space agency which has superseded the military space missions. But who's running it? The CIA is putting camera satellites in a civilian mission, taking photos of the Soviet Union and showing they could do it. So we know the CIA was involved in NASA even from the very beginnings. NASA was a way for the CIA to get control of the space program. So the pretext was budget, the pretext was competition, but what happened when we had a NASA? Through a budget that had no congressional oversight, you had Project Corona taking pictures of the Soviet Union. It was very laudable, but of course who was analyzing those photos? Wasn't the Army, wasn't the Navy, wasn't the Air Force, it was the CIA, which then gave back false estimates. But the point is that it was a pretext. The Civilian Space Agency was a pretext for the real advances that the military had already made in space missions. By the time we were monkeying, no pun intended, with Project Corona in 1959, on the drawing boards was a full-blown, capable of being funded with its own separate command structure, a military outpost on the moon. But it was a military outpost on the moon that wasn't just looking down on planet Earth, but out into orbital space, because we were not just monitoring Soviets, we were monitoring extraterrestrial traffic. And that's what the CIA was trying to keep from the American people.
Oh, my God.
And you know, Art, at this point, one of the most germane questions is, did President Kennedy realize these facts that he just outlined, and could that have been part of the reason for that extremely famous quote about, I want to take the CIA and tear it into 1,000 pieces and cast it to the wind?
Yes.
Now, Mr. Burns is pointing to the colonel, so here is Colonel Corso.
Okay.
Oh, I'm back.
Hi, Colonel.
1962, I testified, well, first, they asked me to testify for my 4 years at the White House and how policy was made and run and the names. I turned them down. They came to my house even. There was a Senate Internal Security Subcommittee on this and Judiciary.
Yes, sir.
And the counsel called me. And I came up. I was still in uniform. I went up there and he said, I want you to testify. I told him, no, I'm not going to testify. And you put it in the archives and it gathers dust. For what reason should I? And he leaned over. He's a big, gruff man. He's a Sawine. And he said, Colonel, I'll subpoena you. And I looked back. I said, go ahead, subpoena me. I get 100 subpoenas. You can't make me talk if I don't want to.
Uh-huh.
So he started to laugh. And I thought, what's going on? And from then on, till the gentleman died, we were great friends. So he looked at me. He said, somebody like you always wants something. What do you want? So it's simple what I want. I'll testify if you can promise me that you'll put it in the hands of the Kennedy brothers. President and Attorney General. Come up tomorrow. I came up the next day. I went to meet Senator Eastland, Chairman of the Judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Eastland told me, he said, Colonel, I promise you I'll put it in their hands myself, personally. So, Senator, call your committee. I'm ready to testify. And Dirksen presided. Keating was there. McClellan. All these powerful senators were there to hear this. I testified for 2 days. Even in front of the House Committee lately, I testified on the missing prisoners of war came up. So they won't release it. It's still top secret because it names the names in CIA. And I told them I went to get a decline. I wanted my testimony. When they told me they couldn't give it to me because they had to protect the source. And then the audience, I said, wait a minute, I'm the source. I don't want to be protected. And the audience started to clap, and the newspaper men even. But this is what was going on. So to get back to the real story, though, then about 2 weeks later, I get a call, and the guy said, the Attorney General wants to see you. So I go across the bridge, went over, and I went to Attorney General Robert Kennedy's office. And he had my testimony, 2 volumes, right on his desk in front of him. So the first thing I said, and I sat down, I told him, this Attorney General, if you and your brother think you make policy, you're sadly mistaken. His answer was, I know that, Colonel. I read your book, your testimony partially, but you and I have to discuss this more thoroughly.
Colonel,
let me finish. Just
sure, real quick. Please.
So, during the course of discussions I had with him, because I went up more than once, UFOs came up. And I told some of the stories to Attorney General Robert Kennedy. Now, I don't know this. I can't verify it. It was his affair, not mine. I think he discussed this with his brother, the president. So that's the story that I have to say of my relationship with the two Kennedys and especially Attorney General Robert Kennedy. And all I have to say, I wish he'd have become president.
Colonel, how old are you now?
Art?
Linda, I wanted to ask the Colonel one other question very quickly.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Colonel, how old are you now?
82.
82. Colonel, how many other people are there that you're aware of?
I can't tell you the number.
That could tell the story.
Well, I can't tell you the number because I lost track of them because there was an agreement, even it's a code in motion pictures in the media, I think you know this, We never reveal the source or reveal someone's name or something unless we get their permission.
So you may be one of the last.
I may be. No, a lieutenant general called me. He was a colonel with me. And he told me, Phil, I know all about when you were chairman or head of the committee to investigate the line of Adams. So he's still alive. As I say, I don't know. Maybe in the group, the loop, even this gentleman called it. You were in the loop. I wasn't. He was a colonel then also. He said, and I know how close you were to General Trudeau. He said, I heard some of the things that you people used to talk about. So how many of the loop that he called it are still alive? I really don't know. I couldn't tell you. It's been almost 40 years. I lost track. I've heard it. Some of them died. Sure, some of them were older than I was. And I'm 82 years old.
Colonel, we're about out of time. It has been an honor for me to speak with you. And I think you're a patriotic person.
No, thank you.
Colonel, thank you. And if you'll hand the phone back to Linda Howe.
Art, don't you feel that for the first time that we are hearing honest voices from inside a portion of this government that is beginning to explain all the questions we've been asking for the last 5 years?
Yes, Linda, I do. I don't know what to say after hearing all of this. I don't know what to say. I'm stunned.
I'll just put in here, I know, and a footnote. When I met the colonel 2 nights ago, the first thing he said to me, he said, Linda Howe, how did you get all of that classified material in your books? And he said, and how did you do it alone? He said, at least I had a gun. And I think part of this big story is that we've had this huge civilian curiosity with so many people, like the ones in Roswell, this 50th anniversary. They knew. They have known. They have their hands on. And we have pushed. And then there has been people like Colonel Corso, who had a gentleman's agreement with an extraordinary general who did finally pass, but his order was for Colonel Corso to then tell the story. And now we may begin to see that the civilian effort that's been pushing forward.
Maybe we'll break it all open. Linda, we're out of time. That's it. I mean, we're flat out.
All right. It's been great, Art.
It's a landmark program. Thank you, Linda. Thank
you.
Thank the Colonel. And please thank Mr. Burns as well.
Yes.
Good night. Wow. All right, folks. That's it. That's a lot to think about, isn't it? I'm Art Bell from an area near the real Dreamland, or Dreamland. This is Dreamland. Good night.
This has been Dreamland, a program dedicated to an examination of areas in the human experience not easily nor neatly put in a box. Things seen at the edge of vision, awakening a part of the mind as yet not mapped. Yet things every bit as real as the air we breathe but don't see. Please join us again next week at this time for Dreamland.